Good evening. Welcome to Mayflower Church. We are thrilled to host this evening's lecture, The Adventure of Civility, with On Being host Krista Tippett. I am Lori Walkie, the associate minister here at Mayflower. I send greetings from our senior minister, Dr. Robin Myers, who is out of town this evening. And since he isn't here, I will tell you that he has moped for weeks about missing the opportunity to hear Krista Tippett live. We don't want to weird you out, Krista, but around here, we consider you family. You must forgive us if we act too familiar. Perhaps you don't realize it, but you have been everywhere with us. We listen to you at work as we tinker with spreadsheets and answer emails, and in the car as we head up the turnpike or down the expressway or just to Grandma's house. You are there during our long runs and bike rides, pushing us to go just a few more miles because, well, Krista has just a few more questions. You've sat on the porch in the morning light, sipping coffee with us, and invited ethicists, astrophysicists, poets, teachers, biologists, preachers, artists, poets, and peacemakers to pull up a chair right at our own kitchen tables. All of this to say, Krista, that we are grateful that you are here. In an age where image and winning are everything, people are still moved by just listening to the spoken word in civil conversation, two people searching for meaning and purpose in life. On Being reminds us that in a world of megaphones and insincerity, the human voice, when vulnerable and focused, is food for the soul. In case it isn't clear, we are so very ready to continue the conversation with you. So to that end, I invite Karen Hulp, General Manager at KGOU, to introduce our guest lecturer.
This is from the manager's desk. And this evening, I'm so happy to welcome you all to this presentation. After that fabulous riff, I almost don't want to know what to say, but thank you to Mayflower Congregational Church for doing this, to Robin and to Lori, who have been just so enthusiastic the moment we asked Robin about it. And so we're very, very grateful and grateful to all of you for coming today. I'll be a little more pedestrian in my introduction of Krista. She is a native Oklahoman. And I learned this just a little bit ago, a granddaughter of a Southern Baptist preacher. She studied history at Brown University and in 83 went to West Germany on a Fulbright scholarship and then spent several years there freelancing news as a reporter and later became special assistant to the U.S. ambassador to West Germany. She left Berlin in 88 and lived in Spain, England, and Scotland and then pursued her Master's of Divinity at Yale. And she graduated in 94. She saw a real emptiness in the where intelligent conversation and coverage of religion was. And she had a couple of projects that led her to the idea that a radio conversation about spiritual and intellectual content of faith could open up imaginations and enrich public life. She is the author of two books. In 2007, Speaking of Faith, it was a memoir of her religion in our time, and then her book, Einstein's God, illustrated some of the important ways the radio program and her vision have continued to evolve. She has two children. She loves cooking, radio plays, beautiful writing, obviously, great science fiction, cross-country skiing, and hot yoga. We're going to have to ask what that is. She is the executive producer of On Being, a Peabody Award-winning public radio conversation. It's also a podcast that's won some Webby Awards, and it's the home of the Civil Conversations Project, an emergent new approach to new conversations and relationships across differences of our ages. So I welcome Krista to the front. Remember that we are recording this presentation for later broadcast. So when we open it up to the questions part, Brian and I will be traveling with a microphone. Please don't start your question until we reach you with the microphone. I would appreciate that very much. It makes for better radio. Thank you very much for coming. Please welcome Krista Tippett.
Thank you so much. It's true, I grew up in Oklahoma. I grew up in Shawnee. But this is now my mother's church. So, I'm home in every way. And I just, I think it's true, isn't it, that you moved the pledge drive when you found out I was coming this week? Yeah. I mean, okay, this occurred to me since I was sitting in the pastor's office, no greater love hath the public radio station than that it move its pledge drive for a visiting host. It's been so wonderful to be here this week, and having all of you here and hearing this beautiful introduction is such an affirmation of the conviction I had 10 years ago that public radio should be a place where we could take on this whole part of life that we call religious and spiritual, and do it with intelligence and balance and in a way that was hospitable and that would open imaginations rather than shut them down. And it was, for that reason, also so exciting for me when KGOU put the show on the air, and I couldn't be happier to be here with you tonight. So thank you to Karen Hulp and Jolly Pugh, who helped organize this, and Reverend Walkie, and I'm also sorry that Reverend Meyer will not be here because he's famous beyond these walls. And I am going to have, I'm going to speak for about 30, 40 minutes, and then we're going to have some time to be in conversation, and that's my favorite part. But I was happy as we discussed what my topic might be, that you were open to me talking about civil conversation, civility, because this is a subject very close to my heart these days. Though, whenever I start speaking about this subject, I always rush to add adjectives to the word civility, like adventure, because I worry that the word civility has connotations of being nice and safe and tame and polite, and that's far too mild to be an antidote to the kind of toxic brew that our current political life has become. And I'm really aware that American civic life has narrowly equated public life with political life in recent years, and I think that this impoverished us. Public life, to me, is bigger than political life. It encompasses political life, but it also encompasses all of our disciplines and endeavors and all of ourselves as professional people, as citizens, as parents. And I find it helpful to start this discussion by pulling back to a long, wide lens on the challenge, why it is so challenging to think about common life at this moment in time. And I start with the fact that I don't think we name very often, that we are turn-of-century people, right? And this terrifying and wondrous century that we have entered is throwing open basic questions, essential definitions that the 20th century thought it had answered. Questions that are intimate and civilizational all at once, definitions of when life begins and when death happens, of the meaning of marriage and family, of human relationship to the natural world, of human relationship to technology and through technology. We are reimagining the very nature of authority, of leadership, of community. We are fundamentally reconsidering how we structure our institutions and our lives together. We are in the midst of nothing less than what I think of as a reformation, but this time of all of our institutions, including politics, education, economics, and, of course, religion. The interesting and challenging thing about this moment is that we know the old ways aren't working anymore, but we cannot yet see what the new forms will be. We're making them up in real time. And here's the clincher, we are facing all of this in a proximity, and an interdependence with different others that is completely unparalleled in human history. We trace the origins of the world's great religious and moral traditions back to what some people call the Axial Age, between the 2nd and 6th century BCE. And that was another era of planetary upheaval, when very separate and disconnected figures on different continents and in separate worlds, Confucius in China, the Buddha in India, the 2nd Isaiah of the Hebrew Bible, around the same time, all of these figures began to make a kindred radical proposal that human flourishing might be connected to more than the well-being of one's own kin and tribe. In some sense, from then to now, we had a choice to imagine that the well-being of far-flung strangers across the globe or across the state, you know, was linked to our own. But in this century of technology that binds, our vulnerability is linked in immediate and intimate ways with the vulnerability of others on the other ends of the planet, and so is our capacity for resilience and innovation. For us, the question, the great ancient abiding human question of what does it mean to be human, has become inextricable from the question of who we are to each other. This magnitude of challenge and change is deeply unsettling for us as human creatures. For most of us, for all of us, some of the time, change and uncertainty generate anxiety and fear. And this is always, at any given time, more true for some of us than others. My dear Oklahoma friend and mentor, Jean Reinbolt, who's here tonight, put some really wise words around this for me earlier this week. He said, there are many among us who can't afford change. And whether that's a reality or a perception, it creates a sense of threat. And what all this wonderful new science of the brain and the body is teaching us is that when we perceive threat, we shut down into survival mode. This shuts down imaginations rather than opening them up. It brings out our worst, most primitive selves rather than our best selves. And when this kind of fear and anxiety shows itself in public life, it often comes out looking like anger, not like fear. It looks like anger. It feels like anger. It's no wonder that cohesive public life has become a frontier to settle, an adventure to dare. My colleagues, my producers and I, have been feeling this same anguish and anxiety as everyone else these years. And it led us, a few years ago, to start a project that we actually started before we gave it a name. We eventually started calling it the Civil Conversations Project. We realized we'd started a kind of cumulative conversation, again, that was as important to us as human beings as it was to us as producers. It began with a series of shows that are very much like all the radio shows, most of the shows we do, with, you know, one in-depth person, I conversation with one person. I interviewed a poet and a civil rights veteran, a philosopher, someone who works with the natural world, a technologist. And then we moved on to some public events, taking on conversations with multiple people involved. Now, this started in the 2010 election season, and then it really intensified at the beginning of 2011, which you will recall is when the shooting happened in Tucson of Representative Gabrielle Giffords and others. And, you know, that entire period of that election season that preceded those events was one of these election seasons where divisive rhetoric had reached really toxic levels. And then suddenly, after those tragic events in Tucson, this new vocabulary briefly entered our public life in speeches and statements, calls for moral imagination and social healing and civil discourse. And the longing behind those calls never went away, but it was also never really met. And what I saw was that while so many of us, including our politicians, resonated with that language, we had no idea anymore how to make them real. We can't see those qualities robustly modeled in many places, many very visible places in our public life, certainly not in our political life. We must discover for our time what moral imagination or social healing or civil discourse can look like in the public sphere. What does it sound like? What makes it possible? Where can we see it embodied? Who will be its leaders? Recently, on NPR, I heard a definition of a politician, that a politician is a conversational entrepreneur. Everybody laughs. The definition was someone who shapes, creates, and launches public discourse. But I think you're probably laughing, as I did, because I don't see many conversational entrepreneurs in our current political class. But I really love that phrase, and I have grabbed onto it. I believe that we are all called to be conversational entrepreneurs at this moment in time, to immediately begin to create the spaces for taking up the hard questions of our time in our fields of endeavor, in our communities, to discover how to calm fear and plant the seeds of the robust civil society that we desire and that our age demands. So people sometimes ask me, do I see politics and media changing anytime soon? You know, as though we citizens will finally be able to get our act together if those spheres can get their act together. And the truth is, things are changing all the time. But our collective need for conversational entrepreneurs is too urgent to wait for politics or media at their most strident to come around. This is a civic calling, and it is a human spiritual calling in the most expansive 21st century sense of that language. It will take vision, and it will take courage. And so what I would like to offer you tonight are four encouragements towards that end. And the first is that words matter. I know this seems an obvious statement to make to a room full of public radio listeners and other above average people. I make it as a journalist, and especially as a journalist, someone who deals in words. This is an important truth to keep reminding oneself of and living by. The words we use shape how we understand ourselves, how we move through the world, how we treat others. Words, in that sense, have the force of action. Wonderful poet who I interviewed last year, Marie Howe, said, you know, I think for many of us, words are mostly what we have left of action. And the world right now needs the most vivid, transformative universe of words that you and I can draw on and give voice to. The last century was driven by vocabularies of technological advance and societal progress that aspired to order our common life by way of ideologies and systems and facts. And when this country first began to experience genuine diversity in the 1960s, the decade of my birth, and that was really the first time genuine diversity religiously, socially, ethnically, we pursued this reasonable order that would be achieved by a civic mandate of tolerance. Tolerance was the primary civic virtue we chose to navigate our first real collective encounter with difference. That word, tolerance itself, was always problematic. Tolerance connotes allowing, enduring, indulging. In a medical context, tolerance is about the limits of thriving in an unfavorable environment. Tolerance is not a lived virtue. It's kind of a cerebral ascent, and it is too cerebral to animate guts and hearts and behavior when the going gets rough. I am not suggesting that tolerance doesn't have its value as a civic tool. It absolutely does. We need it. But I'm saying it's not big enough. It was never big enough from a human spiritual perspective, and We're in a church. I don't think it was ever big enough from a Christian perspective. Tolerance never asked us to engage, much less to care about the stranger. Tolerance doesn't even invite us to understand, to be curious, to open, to be moved or surprised by each other. That week of the Tucson shootings back in 2011, the way this worked was our show goes up on the satellite on a certain day of the week, and it was too late for us to shuffle things around. But of course we thought, well, you know, what would be the perfect show for a week of national tragedy? There was no perfect show, but what we had scheduled that week was an interview with another poet, Elizabeth Alexander, and we were frankly kind of worried about whether that would seem relevant in a week of national tragedy. That podcast with Elizabeth Alexander went through the roof on iTunes. She talked about how we are starved for fresh language to approach each other. She talked about how we crave, and she saw this in her children too, we crave words that shimmer, individual words with power, words to convey real truth, which is something different from conveying facts. We, I believe, have hit the limits of our collective belief in facts to necessarily tell us the whole story or even to tell us the truth. And Elizabeth Alexander says this is one of the reasons that her milieu, poetry, is magnetic, because poetry gets at undergirding truths, at the essence of the world and ourselves. That's very hopeful language in and of itself. You know, in all of our challenging discussions and the poisoned divides we need to cross, we have to find ways to surface undergirding truths. So here are some lines of poetry of Elizabeth Alexander. Poetry is what you find in the dirt in the corner, over here on the bus, God in the details, the only way to get from here to there. Poetry, and now my voice is rising, is not all love, 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 and I'm sorry the dog died. Poetry, here I hear myself loudest, is the human voice. And are we not of interest to each other? I love that question. Are we not of interest to each other? That is an inquiry into undergirding truths. And my second encouragement flows nicely from that, and that is to rediscover questions, questions as civic tools. In American life, we mostly trade in answers, and we trade in competing answers, or in questions which aren't really questions at all, but tools or weapons meant to catch and incite or at least entertain. But in that, of course, I'm not talking about public radio there, but I see my general manager here. But you know what I'm talking about. And in that ever-present spectacle, there is a truth I would invite you to notice and ponder, and that is what a powerful thing a question is. Here's how I experience it, that questions elicit answers in their likeness. A couple of years ago, I was invited by the Lilly Endowment to attend a gathering they were having, very interesting gathering after a 10-year project, and it was with leaders of churches and seminaries, and it was really a big conversation about the future of Christianity, which is a big question. And I sat in on some of their discussions, and I heard this very wise man, whose name I will never know, talk about how amazed he was at the discussions no one was having. And he said, so often the discussions we need to be having are thwarted by the wrong question. And he said, the wrong question leads to the wrong answer, which leads to a simplistic conclusion, which leads to a meaningless argument. Which is such an amazing description of so many of the bad dialogue we hear in our culture. Now, I know sometimes when I talk about this, educators get a little nervous because, you know, we all learn, and I certainly did learn growing up, that there's no such thing as a bad question. And I'm not contradicting that. I sometimes, often, precisely what is needed to cut through to what matters is a simple question. I'm talking about the intentionality, though, the intentionality behind a question. It is hard to meet a simplistic question with anything but a simplistic answer. It is hard to transcend a combative question. But I can state this positively. It is hard to resist a generous question. There is something redemptive and life-giving about asking a better question. And we do have it in our power to formulate questions that invite dignity and honesty and revelation. I have learned that it is even possible to start new conversations that don't trace the predictable ground or end in the predictable stalemate on some of these hot-button issues before us, and you start that by reframing your animating question. We can all refuse to have the same old black and white impoverished either-or choice. Are you pro-life or pro-choice, pro-guns or against guns, pro-gay marriage or against gay marriage? We can start new discussions aimed at the adventure of exploring what is at stake for us in human terms, in these dilemmas, these challenges. So my mother heard me talking about this a couple of days ago, and she said I need to be more concrete and give more examples. And since I am a mother myself now, I have learned that mothers are not always, but often, right. So, for example, in the civil conversations discussions we had with multiple people, I had a searching discussion with two evangelicals, one of them, the head of Focus on the Family, who is not James Dobson. We all think James Dobson, but there's a guy named Jim Daly there who's quite different, the same in many ways and different in other ways. And the question that the two of us considered was, the three of us, how to be convicted and truthful and gracious and loving. How to balance words and rhetoric and a fervor for truth with these virtues of faith. And it was a beautiful discussion that touched everybody in the room. And the head of Planned Parenthood was in the room. I had a conversation with two people who've been on very different sides of the gay marriage issue. And we did not talk about whether gay marriage should be legalized or not. We did talk about what would it take, our animating question, what would it take for our collective confrontation with this issue to become redemptive rather than divisive? And again, it was a very searching, moving discussion. And I'm very proud, we had a discussion about abortion, again with two people who have been on the two sides of that, which we simply refuse to frame in terms of pro-life and pro-choice. In fact, we almost succeeded at not even using that language. Now, to be clear, when you start these big, complicated, intimate civilizational issues in another place, it does not make them simpler, right? These conversations were big and provocative and messy in a whole new way. We got into territory like whether the sexual revolution was really good for any of us and how to rehumanize and deepen our relationship to sexuality in public as well as private spheres. It was unsettling, but it was thrilling because it showed all kinds of possibilities that we could never imagine before in this, you know, the dead end discussions we've seen repeated over and over again. And it opened lines of inquiry that we realize we've been needing to pursue with each other, but that had been completely obscured by the predictable debates. I also need to point out that what I'm not talking about here, and this is a bit of a paradigm shift, is reaching common ground on these issues as a primary goal, as any kind of immediate goal. All of our favored modes of engaging difference drive to resolution, right? You win the debate, you get on the same page, you know, or you take a vote and you move on. And the people who lost have to live with it. Or we make the move that tolerance alone often made of celebrating diversity and celebrating our differences by putting them up on a pedestal and failing to engage their messiness and their depths, and also what makes us really interesting to each other. Robust civility, civility as an adventure, says that there is value moving forward in learning to speak together honestly and relate to each other with dignity without reaching agreement. This, we can start new encounters that don't have to be about bringing other people around to our way of seeing things or going in with a willingness to change our mind and give up the ground we stand on. This is about creating new possibilities for moving forward while being different and even continuing to hold profound disagreement. One of the treasured conversation partners I've had in this civil conversations journey is Frances Kissling, who was for a long time the head of Catholics for Choice. She was a very well-known pro-choice advocate. She's very famous as a pro-choice advocate, but what's less known is that when she retired from Catholics for Choice about 5 years ago, she decided to give herself over to figuring out what it would be to be in real relationship with her political opposites. And it has been an incredible journey she's been on. So she was one of the people who was part of that dialogue we had with a man named David Gushy, who's a Christian theologian and who's been more on the pro-life side, although obviously we didn't use that language, so we bust out of those boxes. But I want to tell you, here's something, and Frances Kissling has really learned so much and is in this relationship that we don't see modeled visibly. And here's one of the things she says about common ground. She says, I'm not a big believer in common ground. I think that common ground can be found between people who do not have deep, deep differences. And in politics, you can find compromise. Politics is the art of the possible. But to think that you are going to take the National Conference of Catholic Bishops and the National Organization of Women, and they are going to find common ground on abortion, is not practical. It's not going to happen. And she said we could extend that. But I do think that when people who disagree with each other come together with a goal of gaining a better understanding of why the other believes what they do, good things come of that. But the pressure of coming to agreement works against really understanding each other. And she says, we don't understand each other. Think of this as a commitment to holding the questions. That's the way I like to think about it. And that comes from the poet Rilke, who has deeply formed me in my work. Rilke talked about the value of holding questions, living questions, honoring questions. So here's what he wrote. Love the questions themselves as if they were locked rooms or books written in a very foreign language. Don't search for the answers which could not be given to you now because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps then, someday far in the future, you will gradually, without even noticing it, live your way into the answer. The intimate, civilizational questions we are revisiting as a culture are not going to be resolved with answers we can all embrace anytime soon. But surely we can agree that we want to live our way into the answers together. Which flows into my third encouragement, that we get to honor the difficulty of what we face, the complexity of what it means to be human. We get to be realistic about how badly we've done this in recent times and to know that we are beginners again, to start small, to realize, for example, very importantly, the critical importance of creating safe spaces before anything profound can happen. Back to that fear place in our brains that our brains send us to in the face of uncertainty and change, we can't ask people to become vulnerable and compassionate and civil with those with whom they passionately disagree without first helping people feel safe. In this, I have been comforted and buoyed by a conversation I had with a very erudite philosopher, Kwame Anthony Appiah. He has an amazing personal story. He's British and African, and his parents' marriage in the 1950s, she was the daughter of a British aristocrat, and she married an African man. And their marriage, their interracial marriage, was one of the two stories that gave rise to the movie Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Right? So within his own family, he lived through one of these places we do live through as human societies again and again, where from one generation to the next, we look back and ask ourselves, what were we thinking, right? And I find that very hopeful because I feel like we're kind of in that place politically right now, that I hope we can think possibly 10 years from now, we can look back and say, what were we thinking? And so then Anthony Appiah went around the world and he started studying how this kind of moral change happens in societies. And here's what we're talking about. We're talking about things that are not just normal, but honorable, right? You know, the idea of interracial marriage then was not just not done. It was morally repugnant, right? And so he looked at, you know, how did foot binding end in China? How did dueling end as an honorable way for gentlemen to resolve disputes? How did slavery end as a foundation, an honorable foundation of the British Empire? And he learned that change began to happen in the human heart over a long period of time, and then the movements come along and uproot the old structures. Change comes about in part, as he describes it, and I love this language, of conversation, as he says, in the old-fashioned sense. Conversation as simple association, habits of coexistence, seeking familiarity around mundane human qualities of who we are. We called that show that we created with him Sidling Up to Difference. So Anthony Appiah says, the way to set moral change in motion is not to go for the jugular or even to go for dialogue right away, not to go straight for the things that divide you. He says, it's completely good and positive to talk about sports or talk about the weather or talk about your children if that's all you can talk about without being angry with each other. He says, make a human connection. What Anthony Appiah calls conversation almost necessarily involves the virtue of hospitality. And this is another way we can be easy on ourselves. As virtues go, hospitality is a very small, reasonable place to start, right? Compassion and reconciliation and love are these superstar virtues, and they take time and they take cultivation. But you don't have to love someone or even like someone or even feel compassionate towards them to practice hospitality. When in doubt, practice hospitality. And I'll leave you with a third calming image, a calming way to imagine ways in to starting something new where we live. And this is from Jean-Paul Lederach, who is a very renowned peacemaker, a master of conflict resolution. He's worked all over the world for the last 3 decades. He's a Mennonite. He's in that Mennonite tradition of peacemaking. And he says that when we think about social change, we tend to think in terms of big movements, right? Critical mass, getting enough people mobilized. But in his experience around the world over these decades, and he worked and he was very involved in change in Northern Ireland, for example, he says that large-scale movements do forge turning points, but they tend to form around what they're opposing and overturning, and they don't necessarily carry the seeds of the new positive forms that are going to shape the future. For that, he says, you need critical yeast. And that is a quality of relationship between unlikely combinations of people. And yeast is a great Christian image, too. It's a great biblical image. So be critical yeast. I'd leave you finally with the comfort that there is so much good news on this front. There are so many wonderful projects of social healing thriving just below the radar. There's something called the Public Conversations Project in Boston. There's Living Room Conversations starting in California. There's a National Institute for Civil Dialogue. And I am sure that every one of you knows of something healing that is happening in this community. And again, it's under the radar. So please know, the radar is broken, right? And we can't let that be our measure of whether something is really important or making a difference or not. My final encouragement to you is drawn from a biblical injunction to develop eyes to see and ears to hear. We live in this time where so much information comes at us constantly from so many directions. And what is failing, what is going wrong, is what drives the headlines. Developing eyes to see and ears to hear is a great spiritual discipline for our time. This is also not just about seeing what's new. It's also about becoming attentive to knowledge that it's already in our midst. It is about attending to elders, to people who are among us who've lived how social change happens. And by the way, all social change started below the radar, even when the radar was working. I've been thinking a lot this last year about the civil rights movement. You know, we're going through all of these milestones, these civil rights milestones. It's an astonishing example of social change in living memory. You know, the conditions could not have seemed more hopeless to those activists who we now see as heroes in the 1960s. Many of those elders are still with us. But our memory of those events, like all memory, is imperfect. And as I've delved into that history with some of these elders, I've been really struck by the lessons they have to teach us if only we seek them out. That, you know, this is right, these lessons are right before us, waiting to be mined and developed for our age. They have reminded me that the movement Martin Luther King led was not at its depths merely about political rights, but about the spiritual goal of creating the beloved community. The civil rights movement used vivid language and asked world-changing questions. The great theologian of the prophets, Walter Brueggemann, you may have heard, we put that show on at Christmas time, pointed out to me that King's, the line that we all remember of King, you know, perhaps his most prophetic statement, was actually a line of poetry. I have a dream. And this year in Montgomery, last year, I interviewed John Lewis, an incredible experience. And I learned just what I never learned in school about the civil rights movement, about the incredible discipline that they applied, the inner confrontation that preceded every outward action. That there was a spiritual confrontation within yourself, so that when you were being beaten, it wasn't just that you refused to strike back. You did not want to strike back because they had internalized love of enemy in an incredible way. They did role-playing and practice and study, and they were reading Gandhi and they were reading Jesus before they ever went into any of these situations. And that's about the inner work that goes hand in hand with the work of really, in a transformative way, engaging the other. This is the territory I'm thinking of now as the territory of grounding virtues as opposed to ground rules. And I find that this language of virtues is very attractive to contemporary people, and especially the young among us, who have a deep service orientation, a commitment to lead lives of authenticity and integrity, and to join inner life with outer action. Another civil rights veteran, Vincent Harding, who spent all these years, he ran the Mennonite House in Atlanta, wrote some of Dr. King's speeches, and he spent these decades being with young people all over the country, places like Detroit, He's been an amazing mentor. He actually is bringing those lessons to the new generation. So I want to give you some lines of his before I close. Vincent Harding said, "For me, the question of democracy also opens up the question of what does it mean to be truly human? Democracy is simply another way of speaking about that question. Religion is another way of speaking about that question. What is our purpose in this world? And is that purpose related to our responsibilities to each other and to the world itself? All of that seems to me to be a variety of languages getting at the same reality." He says, "My own feeling, as I try to share again and again, Krista, is that when it comes to creating a multiracial, multiethnic, multireligious, democratic society, we are still a developing nation." And then with a long view of time, which is so un-American but so important for us to try to regain, he says, "We've only been thinking about this for half a century. But my own deep, deep conviction," Vincent Harding says, "is that the knowledge, like all knowledge, is available to us if we seek it." This is a wonderful message to let ourselves take in, that we're in the midst of a long-term project. And it's a wonderful message to give to the young among us who get the message much of the time that they have their work cut out for them fixing all the things we've broken, right? But to say this, too, is all of our calling, to grow up this democracy to its full political as well as its full human spiritual potential, to convene and curate different encounters and new forms our world is giving birth to speak the language of these new forms into vitality, to become conversational entrepreneurs, forces of social healing. May you develop eyes to see and ears to hear civility as the great adventure it is, and to take it up in ways none of us can yet imagine. Thank you. So we have a roving microphone, and we can talk about anything. We can talk about civility or public radio or whatever is on your mind.
My question is,
that's better.
To what extent does the influence of money on discourse tend to drown out and actually defeat the purpose of a meaningful conversation? I mean, the Koch brothers can spend untold millions conveying one message, which is anything that Obama doesn't want. And how do you overcome that? And I mean, it's one thing for tiny voices to speak up, but they don't have the money or the resources that the Koch brothers have. So,
well, I don't think you or I can take on the Koch brothers. I mean, we can't take on that kind of money. But I do believe that we have power over our spaces. We have power in our communities, and I think we have to start there. And then I don't know, but I think if we try to work out the scenario about how we can make sure that in the end we have as loud a voice as the richest person in America, then we probably won't start, you know? And somehow we have to begin.
Hi, Krista. Thank you so much for being here. My question is in reference to radar, and that you said the radar is broken, but it was not broken in the 60s, and I was wondering if you could clarify that a little bit, please.
Well, I don't know if it wasn't broken in the 60s. I mean, I I say one way that I think it's broken, that it just can't possibly work anymore, is it used to be possible here because there were three television channels and newspapers that people read every day. There were privileged voices, and if something reached a certain level of visibility, you know, it had a platform. Or if, but the world we live in and the ways people act and speak and write and communicate are so dispersed. I mean, and all, you know, now it's also probably important to say that the radar was always a bit of an illusion, but it was an illusion we all bought into, right? I mean, think about it. When I left Oklahoma, you know, I went to the East Coast, I discovered the New York Times, and I read the New York Times like sacred text every day, right? And I am just amazed, you know, that there's that ridiculous sentence on the, I mean, I still think the New York Times is probably the best newspaper we have, but the slogan, all the news that's fit to print, and nobody laughed, all right? But somehow, it's only just in the last 5 years that any of us would have noted how absurd it was. That, you know, and I actually once went to the noon editorial meeting at the New York Times. You know, it was like 8 people sitting in the room, white guys, about the same age, and they were going to tell us all the news. So maybe the radar was always an illusion, but there was a radar, and if you hit it, you know, I mean, I wonder if somebody like King, or, you know, would have the kind of visibility that he was able to have then, you know. But now what is happening everywhere, and we have to, we, you know, in a very interesting way, and this is the upside of technology, we have a capacity to create our own tribes, our own communities of meaning, our own identities, right? We are not limited anymore to geography or our given identities. But that's just all happening, and it's not going to be registered in any place that everybody is going to see at any given time.
Krista, my heart's beating so fast because I listen
to you
every evening.
Oh, okay.
You calm my soul when I go to sleep at night, so thank you for that. My question is, how concerned or how concerned should we be how smart our smartphones are to make our young adults dumb?
Yeah. Well, It's the reality. It's their world. You know, I've been hearing lately this language of digital natives, right? And I, you know, technology has upsides. Technology has downsides. But I really have been shaped by conversations I've had these years about technology with people who work in technology, who remind me that the internet is in its infancy, right? It feels to all of us like it's not only huge, it has taken over our lives, it, you know, it runs everything, it's Big Brother. But it is waiting to be shaped to human purposes, and that is our job. We have to shape it to human purposes. And, you know, we've been on this treadmill, especially these last 5-10 years, where suddenly we all have smartphones. I mean, that's not even language we would have used probably 2 years ago, right? I mean, isn't that incredible? And technology proceeds at this digital pace, this 24/7 pace. When we are analog creatures, we will never, ever function at that pace. So there's this disconnect that we are going to have to reconcile. And I think that those of us who, for whom this landed in the middle of our lives, so it's like we stepped onto this uncharted frontier and we are just trying to keep up. I think it's hard for us to answer that question or imagine an answer to that question. I do believe that our kids, who are natives in this digital world, are going to be, they, you know, they intuitively get this stuff more than we do, and I think that they are going to have different instincts about how to make it work for human beings. And I mean, if you talk about technology, certainly you can point to all kinds of horrible things, but I also see a lot, you know, I see kids relating, you know, every individual kids relate differently to technology. You really can't generalize as much as we think we can about how people live with that stuff. And I just think it's very new, it's been very fast, but I believe and I see them kind of gradually pulling their heads up out of this, and they're going to figure this out, and really we don't have a choice but to trust them. And be good elders when the time comes. Yeah.
Okay, so I have a question. I'm 16, and I was wondering, what questions do the youth need to ask each other in order to have redemptive conversations for the future to make more constructive, positive change?
Well, that's a big question. This is probably the one my mother wanted me to be prepared for. Well, let me just give you an idea about how to start conversations that's different from the way we usually start conversations, right? We're kind of trained to start conversations with opinions or, you know, I believe statements or I think statements or to gather around an issue. And it's interesting to think about gathering around a question rather than issue. And, you know, it might be issue-related. It might be about immigration or race or politics, but phrase it as a question, the question that you hold about this thing. And that maybe it's phrased in a way that it's a question that everybody can, you know, agree that they're kind of curious about. Before you get into the what I believe, ask people to, let me tell you this, when the seeds for my show were really in a place, an ecumenical institute of some Benedictines in the middle of nowhere in Minnesota. And they had this amazing ecumenical institute that really did change the world. Like, here's, you know, one. There's so many examples of this, right? Nobody here has ever probably heard of St. John's Abbey. Maybe somebody has. But they absolutely changed the world in this very quiet way. And there's lots of change that happens that way. So they would take a hard question in ecumenism, but you could do this with politics too. You know, it might be... what is prayer, or I don't know, or who is God? And people have different opinions about that. But they would start by saying, answer the question through the story of your life. And you would actually get all the deep thinking and the history and the theology that people had to bring to that, but they brought it in a different way. They brought it in as a human being, as opposed to an expert or a talking head. And they brought it in with a story which everyone there could... Stories are listenable in a way that opinions aren't for very long. And when the positions surfaced, as they did, because they do, you know, we are creatures who pursue truth and need to articulate truth. And I think our integrity is in our truth-telling as well. But as those truths surface, and of course they did, people around the circle had a really different, you know, that's not their truth, or they had a really different way of coming at it, that was not a disembodied position, you know? It was a truth that had a face and a voice and a story. And not only could they take in what this other person was saying and honor it in a sense, but they would never be able to completely dismiss that entire group of people who think that way ever again. So I don't know if that's helpful, but the trick about those dialogues is when you ask people to answer a question through the story of their life, you know, you need to give people those things took 5 days. So, we rarely have that time, but you may not know this, but I start every interview that I do on the radio with the same question. You don't always hear this question. We don't always edit it into the show. But the question is, whoever I'm talking to an atheist astrophysicist, I'm talking to a poet, I ask them about if there was a religious or spiritual background to their childhood. And for one thing, everybody has an amazing story. Everybody has a story to tell to that question. It's a question that is inviting and kind of interesting to people in a way. It's exactly the opposite if I said, tell me about your religious and spiritual life now, right? Which any of us would freeze. But the real reason I ask that question is because of where it plants people for the rest of the conversation. That question takes them to a place in themselves that is softer and searching, and that probably was about questions that, you know, they may have kept following this, you know, the rest of their life. So, you know, I can't prescribe precisely the question you might want to ask, but I hope that gives you an idea of how to think about form. It's where do you want to plant the conversation, and it's the angle at which you want to come at the questions. Okay, good. I got a thumbs up.
I listen to all the things that are being said about, you know, a lot of the things like this church talks about love thy neighbor, every single neighbor, and so on. But if you really look at it, somehow this just kind of seems like a pipe dream, sort of, in that when you turn on the TV today, and God knows I'm not a prune, I'm pretty old, yeah, but you can hardly watch TV anymore. And I like a dirty joke as much as anybody, but TV today is to the point where you can't watch it anymore. So I enjoy going back to 2000 and watching old stuff because of what you see. And it just seems like there's this trend that none of this matters. None of this matters. The only thing that matters is the almighty dollar. And the people who get these dollars influence the people so much that I really have a hard time seeing how anything good can ever happen.
Are you talking about news, TV news especially, or talk shows?
I'm talking about mostly entertainment shows. I mean, the news on the TV, I probably don't really believe a lot of that.
Yeah.
And in Oklahoma, I mean, everything is so tilted that the news sounds, to me, I just don't have much faith in it.
Yeah.
And they can't even be civil on the stuff. They have to always have their right-wing opinion, let's say. So, anyway.
I know exactly what you're talking about. And I didn't watch television much for years. I am going to stand up, though, there's a lot of great quality TV suddenly beginning. You know, you are absolutely right that it's raw and it contains graphic violence and nudity, a lot of it. It's just like our kids just are exposed to things that would be unimaginable for us. And you do actually kind of have to get past that, which may be a sad thing. But I really see a renaissance. You know, we human beings are storytelling creatures. We've always made meaning with stories. And there's just something really interesting that started happening in the last few years of television becoming, again, this primary place where we tell these stories. And I just finished watching Breaking Bad, which I didn't want to watch. But first of all, it's brilliant drama and scripting and acting and real social commentary. And there's this show that was on last year called The Bridge, which is a murder mystery based on the Texas-Mexico border, but also incredible social commentary about that border and about immigration and about the murder of young women in Juarez, which is one of these stories I can't even read in the newspaper because it's so devastating. There's a show, you know, Orange is the New Black, which is really opens your mind about who's in prison and why. So I guess I want to encourage you to give TV maybe a little more of a try. I think there's something really wonderful happening in TV, and it's a good news story as opposed to a lot of the bad news stories.
Hi, I want to first tell you I met you a couple of years ago driving home one summer night. Caught the middle of an interview you were doing with Roseanne Cash.
Oh, yeah.
It was fabulous. Yeah. I say it was an NPR driveway moment. I just sat in the driveway and finished it out. It was great. So the notion of civility, I remember when I felt like the wheels fell off that wagon when President Obama was giving his State of the Union address several years ago, and one of our elected officials yelled out, "You lie."
Yeah.
And I literally said out loud, what happened to the rules? And you've touched on that tonight. I like the way you've reframed it with regard to ground virtues. What are the ground rules? What are the ground virtues? And so as we very bravely continue into this century and look to discover what those ground virtues are, how do we balance those discussions, which I completely agree with you on, that these things take time, with the sense of urgency that I feel, and perhaps others as well, just in regard to how things are sort of shaping up around here?
Yeah, that there's a lot of bad behavior out there, right? You mean? We do have a sense of urgency, and yet, as I said, I really think this person, John Paul Lederach, who I mentioned, the peacemaker, he stopped talking in terms of conflict resolution as what he does, because he said, you know, you can resolve a conflict, you can resolve every conflict, but if you don't transform the conflict, if you don't transform the dynamics, then may that happen. It will revisit you. It will recur. It will take shape again and rise up. So he will not take on a project anymore with any group that's not willing to devote 10 years. And it's unimaginable in this culture that we would start something and say it's going to take 10 years. But I'm afraid, you know, that is the reality here, that we our sense of urgency is a moral thing. But we have to temper it with a longer view of time. We also, I feel like we're kind of trained by, I'm not sure what has done this, the news. We're trained to generalize on the bad examples, on the, you know. One try to think about is like taking in the good, because we orient towards what is bad, right? And I think, you know, what defines, we talked to, you know, hard-bitten journalists, you know, the news is the extraordinary thing that happened today. It is the disaster, the earthquake, and this is kind of eyes to see and ears here, kind of shaking ourselves out. You know, I remember as I started thinking about this, you know, waking up, You will hear a story in the morning on the news about some, you know, today a kindergarten teacher in Siberia attacked her students, right? And an automatic reaction is, what is the world coming to, right? Well, how many millions, gazillions of kindergarten teachers today did not attack their students, right? I mean, it doesn't mean that these things don't matter. They do, but I also think we see this guy who yells and breaks the rules and breaks standards of decency, and, you know, what is the world coming to? But we really can't let ourselves generalize on the basis of the worst behavior. And we also can't... something that's been very helpful to me to learn that really comes from some psychological and scientific work now is that we know that the group we come from, including our families, is incredibly diverse and full of, even though it's part of our identity, full of people who are very different from us. But when we look at another group, we assume a homogeneity that we would know isn't there in our group. And I think often, especially in this polarized landscape, You know, we don't just assume it's homogeneous. We assume they're all like that guy who stood up and yelled. And so, you know, I guess a lot of what I'm saying is kind of coming back to perspective, kind of just again and again, I think we have to pull back and let ourselves breathe. Maybe this is why Buddhism is becoming so essential to modern people. We had to learn to breathe again and be present and let things be what they are for a while.
We have a question from the balcony.
Hey, Krista, I want to thank you for coming. My question is kind of a follow-up to what she just asked you. I think she used the word urgency. And my thought is you, the gentleman that you just referenced who said he wouldn't take on a debate or argument unless he had a 10-year period of time, I think from a historical context, a lot of the major change that's happened, especially in the United States, has happened in a relatively short period of time. It's usually around acute issues that need to be resolved really importantly. And one thing that comes to mind today, currently, is the global warming issue, which is rather acute. And I feel like the idea, and I wonder if the argument that you made tonight, which is eloquent, and I certainly buy into it as being a person who can be long-winded and cerebral, but in practicing in actuality, if the idea of drawing out and elongating and protracting arguments out and giving equal weight sometimes to sides causes a wash in the end, which is harmful long-term, especially in regard to global warming.
So I don't want to suggest, I mean, what I'm, look, there's a whole, at any given moment, there are a range of issues and problems and challenges, and some of them do need to be addressed today and tomorrow. So I'm not saying that is not also part of our reality. I'm just saying that everything is not like that. And especially this coming to agreement over these big moral issues, I think we just need to spend some time agonizing together and getting to know each other. I agree with you, you know, whether you call it climate change or, you know, however you diagnose it, I think we know that our relationship to the natural world matters. And I also see there's so much happening on that front, you know, at every level. I mean, there are scientists who are working on it, and there are churches working on it, and there are people in communities, in all kinds of communities. I think what frustrates me about that phenomenon is I want those dots to be connected more effectively, you know, because there really is. There's a lot of sense of urgency that is being taken up. So I'm not denying that reality as part of the big picture either. I'm really not. But I'm saying that we need some discernment about what really does need resolution and what even can be resolved and what we need to hold and live into. But even with the climate change stuff, I mean, that's also, you know, there are things we can do today and tomorrow, and then there are some. That is going to require a magnitude of, you know, big picture planning that we really have not, you know, we have not been up to now. And this may be what forces us to gain some new capacity. But there's a big long-term piece in that, too, that's going to require some new discipline of us. And it's going to be really interesting to see what happens, and scary.
I'm still rearranging the word furniture in my mind to ask this, so if it doesn't come out quite clearly, I apologize. I don't know if I'm missing something, but I keep thinking of the question about the small voices becoming unified to start a change, and I think about music. It seems as though a lot of the great movements had a unifying musical theme.
Yeah.
I keep thinking of Battle Hymn of the Republic or Glenn Miller in World War II. I'm not hearing the music, the tune that would unite the small voices into a movement. Am I missing something?
No, I've thought about that a lot. The Pete Seeger, who just died, right? And this is actually something that the civil rights people talk about all the time. I mean, I think John Lewis said we sang our way to freedom. And I went on this pilgrimage, a civil rights pilgrimage with him and actually a congressional delegation from both parties. And we went to Selma, we went to the University of Alabama, where George Wallace stood in the doorway and blocked the students from entering, and we went to the Baptist church which was firebombed, and those little girls, and we went to all these places where marches started and ended, and they all started with singing, and they sang all the way, and they sang all the way home. And that was a huge part of it. And earlier this year, I interviewed the Indigo Girls, and so it's Emily Saliers and Amy Ray. And Amy is really the more political of the two. And I actually asked her about this. And she said that it's a real concern for her, too. She said, where are the protest songs? Where's the music that's binding us? And she said that this is a real topic of conversation among musicians. And it hasn't, you know, I think it's bubbling up. It hasn't really reached us yet, but that's going to be interesting to watch how that comes out. But you're absolutely right. It's critical.
Krista, do we have time for another question or two?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, Krista. My question has to do not with the large topics of global warming and some of the divisive issues in our community, but even civility in our neighborhoods and how we deal with each other on a person-to-person, and particularly I'm not sure how we can even address those larger questions when, let me give you an example. It's really scary to walk around my neighborhood because people don't yield in crosswalks, and I think it's like a car person kind of thing, and I perceive that as a sort of a disregard for me as a vulnerable user of our streets. So that's just an example, and so I'm wondering how we can even address those small bits of civility on our way to the larger questions.
Well, I don't feel like I could tell you how to handle that, but I would say, again, I feel that's a question you're holding. And I would say, you know, start by finding one other person, another neighbor, and share that question with them. And, I mean, you know, and I think we get so hung up on playing out the scenario and thinking about the major change and the laws that would be passed, right, and all the places that something would need to go to affect change as we understand it, and then we don't do the small things of just starting that conversation, creating that relationship. I really do believe that questions are powerful things, and that, you know, that we sometimes don't act if we don't have an answer. We don't speak if we don't have an answer, right? We don't move if we don't have an answer. And I think you can start with that question and start some unlikely combination of neighbors, start some yeast, and tell me how it goes. I believe this, but it's a new way of being, and we're kind of experimenting. Maybe one more question.
Elda, thank you so much for coming tonight. It's interesting that you talked about the civil rights movement. August 19th, 1958, a group of kids went to Catch Drugstore here in Oklahoma City and asked for a hamburger and asked to be served. I was that seven-year-old child that sat at that counter back in 1958. I say that not to get applause, but to ask the question, what is it that this audience, these are intelligent, well-educated, middle class, probably upper middle class listeners that are here tonight. And I ask the question, what can this audience do in terms of the inner work that you spoke of earlier, in terms of not only being in integrity with themselves, but to put aside the question or pose the question for themselves that it's not about me. And when you look at what's happening in Oklahoma in terms of the rankings, in terms of the reputation that Oklahoma has embraced, I say that very tongue-in-cheek because, like you, I left here many, many years ago and went to the East Coast and only came back recently. But I think the idea that you're having this conversation with us, I think it's something that's front and center that maybe when people leave here and they're on their way home to their comfortable environment, they can say, the work that I need to do is not about me, but it's about the people that live near me that are across town. And then I think of the question that one of the previous participants said, you know, ain't gonna let nobody turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. You know, that song comes in my mind so many times. I'm gonna keep on walking to freedom land. And sometimes when you get so comfortable with having those Princeton University degrees or OU degrees or even where I went to college, George Washington University in Washington, we get so comfortable that we don't ask that question or we don't think about the person that's across town and that what is happening in my environment impacts me. So if there was a message to give tonight that people could take with them in terms of doing the inner work, in terms of taking action, in terms of not being just a talker but a walker, what would that message be tonight?
That's such a hard question. It's the question. I think everybody here, you know, has the answer for themselves, but that's a cop-out, so that's not where I'm going to end. I learned this, there was this African proverb that the civil rights leaders all knew, you know, when you pray, move your feet. We are so segregated in this culture, and I don't just mean racially. We associate that word with race, yes, racially, but also we're segregated by age. We're segregated by people in our own socioeconomic class. And so when we feel anguish, as so many of us do, about things that are wrong, you know, in our own city, the problem is we have no very realistic imagination about how we could change it because we really don't have a relationship with those people we'd like to help. And I think, you know, we have a tendency to leap to how can we do acts of justice. And, you know, there's a lot of good work that happens, but if we really don't have those relationships with people and we don't know them, we can't actually effectively move across that void. And so I kind of return to this, you know, it's not the romantic thing to do is not to say I have to make a relationship, I have to look other people in the eyes. And that actually takes more time than maybe volunteering or starting some action. But on the other hand, you could see it as we get to return to this basic work of being human beings among other human beings. And it is, though, going to be for every person, and I include myself in this, you know, to figure out what it means in my neighborhood, in my community, to get to know someone, to have a human understanding that can lead to me being effective in helping create the world that I want to live in. As you say, it's not just about improving my own lot, but create the world I want to live in and the world I want my children to live in. I'm in this with you. I will say one thing, and this is, you know, we're thinking really hard about this at On Being, and we are creating a resource talking about these grounding virtues and starting conversations, and we're actually just doing that now, and we started a website, civilconversationsproject.org. The resources aren't there yet, but they will be probably in the summer, and I would love to stay in conversation with you I'm not hard to find. And tell me if things happen as a result of this evening, or if it just opens up questions that need to be put out there as well. So I would hope that, you know, this is the beginning of my conversation with you, and maybe my project can interact with this as well. It's been really wonderful to be here, and this has been a very searching and hard conversation in the best sense, so thank you for that.
I think that says it best. Thank you all for coming. Although I want to take one more minute of your time, I would be remiss in not mentioning a very important happening in Oklahoma City. If you are looking for something that is under the radar, conversations that are happening right now, relationships that are being built, please look up Voice. Yay! Voices organized in civic engagement, and that is a grassroots organizing group that is doing good work in our community and in our cities. Or you can call our church office to find out more information, 842-8897. Please get involved. We're having house meetings and conversations, listening and talking to one another, and it is a beautiful thing what Krista is trying to work on. Thank you for coming. Have a good night, folks.